During the Syrian civil war, tens of thousands of people have been detained, tortured, raped and murdered by the regime of Bashar al-Assad. In April 2020, one of his intelligence officials, Anwar Raslan, was put on trial in Germany, accused of participating in those crimes. Now he's been found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. As the case was reaching a climax, reporter Nina Donaghy went behind the scenes to find out how the evidence against Raslan was gathered. This is the second of two special episodes.
In the unlikely setting of this picturesque city on the banks of the Rhine, a trial has been heard for the past 18 months. Here in Koblenz, a once powerful Syrian official is on his way to court, and his fate is soon to be decided.
Anwar R. is charged with 58 cases of murder and killing and at least 4,000 cases of torture as a crime against humanity. Two cases of sexual assault, now also as a crime against humanity, and severe deprivation of liberty.
Patrick Croker is part of the prosecution team who've been working on this landmark trial, and he's preparing final arguments.
This trial is about the guilt or innocence of one person, but we are speaking about mass crimes, systematic crimes, and there is a system behind it and specific hierarchies in place in Syria that we need to tackle as well.
For the past decade, President Bashar al-Assad has been waging a vicious war against his own people, obliterating areas showing opposition, using any means at his disposal, including barrel bombs and chemical weapons. Germany is leading the way in international justice, prosecuting this man, Colonel Anwar Raslan, a former Syrian intelligence officer.
Germany recognized what's called universal jurisdiction, which means it has jurisdiction to take prosecution, even if the crime didn't get committed in Germany and didn't get committed against a German.
Stephen Rapp has been at the forefront of international war crimes trials for the past 20 years.
Germany is a country that has the broadest laws in this space and frankly recognizes its own responsibility from its history. And German law does permit it to investigate crimes of international concern because they involve torture, which is a norm protected by the Torture Convention and respected supposedly by all of humankind, and crimes against humanity and war crimes that were prosecuted at Nuremberg. These are crimes that states can prosecute even if they don't occur on their territory.
In Koblenz, five judges preside over the first ever Syrian war crimes tribunals. A junior intelligence officer has already begun a 4.5-year sentence, but the trial of his commander, Anwar Raslan, is the landmark case.
He was a colonel involved and in charge of interrogation and interrogation in detention facilities, specifically 251 at Al-Khatib in Damascus. He's a colonel, he's in charge of interrogation. He's making up the lists of who gets brought in. He knows what's happening in these situations as people are being, bent over double and their spines cracked. He knows what's happening when people are whipped and burned. Now, he purported to defect. He told people that he was going to cooperate and provide assistance, never did. He tried to present himself very much as a repentant, low-level individual and, frankly, drew attention to himself with the Germans.
Anwar Raslan arrived in Germany seeking asylum, but in fact stayed loyal to the regime. Now his trial is unmasking the crimes and network of torture centers at the heart of the Syrian state.
The Syrian secret services can literally do everything they want. Arrest whomever they want, make them disappear, and nobody would find out and nobody would be held responsible. And so this is a very, very powerful tool for a dictatorship. They are basically controlling every aspect of life in Syria.
In 2011, as people took to the streets protesting President Assad's repressive regime, his intelligence service was carefully documenting its brutal response. Hundreds of thousands of people were detained and tortured. The state systematically recorded their fate, even those who were murdered.
In Syria, as in Nazi Germany, there was, a mania for record keeping. To some extent, people were covering their backsides. And so when decisions were made about rounding people up or arresting this group or that, there were security meetings, and there were signatures of everybody who attended those meetings. They were reporting up through the system, saying, oh, we've got too many corpses rotting in our hospital here. Somebody's going to have to clean out all these people that were killed in Facility 235.
Facing deadlock at the UN, Ambassador Rapp had to find an alternative route.
With the Security Council blocked, we've had to turn to other parts of the United Nations, initially to the Human Rights Council in Geneva, where it was possible to establish a commission of inquiry. That began to go to work in 2011, and it's been going on for 10 years. But that's not enough. So in the U.S. in 2012, and I started pushing the idea that we should support NGO investigations that were truly robust, that would do it like Scotland Yard in the U.K. would do, or the FBI, or like the investigative arms of the tribunals where I was a prosecutor.
Evidence to support such tribunals has been painstakingly gathered together and stored in this secret location.
So this is one of two evidence rooms we have in the headquarters. This one has, I think, up to 260 boxes.
These are the documents that can hold the Syrian state to account.
The boxes can contain from 1,000 to 4,000 pages, depends on how they were collected inside Syria, and will contain either handwritten or printed documents. In this particular box, we have interrogation reports, so they are handwritten and stamped by the unit from which they came.
But this isn't the UN or a state-run intelligence operation. It's a private initiative, an NGO, part-funded by sympathetic nations.
I had been working on post-conflict justice for a number of years, and there were a lot of victories there, but also a lot of disappointments, including disappointments with the criminal justice system and how much accountability can really bring you so many years after the war. And here was a conflict that was happening. I thought, well, what are the lessons that we can apply?
Nerma Yelicic is now working on justice for Syria at the Commission for International Justice and Accountability, CIJA. When CIJA began, there was one fundamental question.
Can linkage evidence, can the documents be collected by a non-public body in a way which would make them admissible in a court? That was the starting premise. Train a bunch of random Syrians affected by this conflict, living in this conflict, from different walks of life. Can we take them and train them not to collect as activists, but to collect as war crimes investigators would?
How many documents are we talking about?
Over the years, we have collected vast amounts. So what we have already managed to extract comes about 1 million pages of the Syrian regime documents. The documents are the king and queen of evidence.
Throughout the trial, Patrick Croker has seen the value of this material in building the case.
What is often very difficult to get to is proof of the chain of command and kind of on the bureaucratic side behind things. That's very often what's lacking in these war crimes trial. You can lay out the network of how, you know, the Syrian intelligence services function with the CJAR files. And this has also been very important in this trial. Once somebody is, you know, from this demonstration being taken away, that's the point in time where often you never see them again. And everything that happens afterwards is behind closed doors, and you're lucky if you get any information at all afterwards. But this is kind of giving us the possibility to really look behind that wall and see how things work on the government side, basically, and also to prove that there is a very, very meticulous systemacy behind it.
But today in court, there's been a problem.
We had a very short witness testimony today in court. It's because somebody didn't appear basically directly as a witness, so the policeman who had taken the testimony originally at the police station, he came to testify about what had been said then. We know from others that they didn't want to come because they felt scared, because there have been threats that were made at least to people that still had family in Syria, so the family in Syria was threatened. And that for them was reason enough to say, I don't want to go to court, I'm afraid, etc.
The Syrian regime is known to have a wide reach, and there have been credible threats against witnesses.
We have, in several instances, heard that especially witness families that are still in Syria, but also in the region, even in Europe, were being threatened when they participated in this trial or were about to participate in this trial. And so this is definitely, I mean, one of the most important aspects. I mean, the security of the people involved is there's nothing more important than that, actually.
Women are also targets. Crimes of sexual violence have been commonplace during the conflict. The Raslan trial will set an important precedent, defining these acts as crimes against humanity.
I think they had a very high level.
Working alongside Patrick is Syrian lawyer Jumana Saif, who's become an expert in this field.
Women bodies were used as a weapon of war. Women, they were arrested, were taken to be raped, to be humiliated, to be tortured, and then sent back to their families and communities. It happened that many times women, they were taken as a hostage, and it's always women used as kind of threat to be brought in, to be raped in front of their men relatives who are arrested, who are in jail. Sexual and gender-based crimes was committed systematically and alongside the other international crimes as torture and killing. And it's important to be recognized as a crimes against humanity. And also that will pave the way in the future for those survivors to be recognized.
Few witnesses have testified in court, and most are too fearful to be interviewed or identified on camera. This woman, we're calling her Amina, was kidnapped from the street and taken to Raslan's unit. She agreed to tell us a part of her story.
We sit on the floor, nothing on the floor. And there is one toilet. It's bad toilet. There's no lights. I see many blood in the corridor. I hear voices, and they threaten me that we will do that and we will do that. And I said, I don't know why I'm here. I don't do anything. I'm not doing anything. They put me alone for 4 days. Nobody speak to me. I'm asking them every time they open the door, why I'm here? please let me out. It's a good way to make the prisoner fall apart.
In this war, women paid the highest price and paid the price twice. And they were arrested, tortured, humiliated, and in the same times after being released, they were punished from the society. They are isolated, maybe stigmatized in from the society.
Finally, Amina was brought before Anwar Razlan.
I met him in his office, and his name is on the desk. I know who he is. He said in hard way that you should not to do that again. I told you I don't do anything. You kidnapped me from the street. He said, no, you are bad, and you shouldn't do that again, and you can go home.
Within the millions of pages of documents, CIJA have created dossiers tracking the chain of command, including specific papers relating to Anwar Razlan.
Here we have selected a couple examples from General Intelligence Directorate, where Anwar Razlan was the head of investigations. But here is an example of an interrogation report dated October 2012, in which we have one, two, three pages, basically, of the results of the interrogation and recommendations that the interrogators sent to the head of General Intelligence. And in this case, they recommend that the individuals are sent to anti-terrorism court for further prosecution. And we have the signature of Razlan. Now, we've blocked out his colleagues, but Razlan's name and signature is here. It's incredible, not only because of what these documents show regarding Razlan's role, but also, and again, very importantly, that he wasn't doing it just because he was some individual who liked doing it. He was doing it as part of a widespread and systematic campaign that the regime unleashed upon these people.
When you put that all together, it's frankly a trove of documentation that exceeds in terms of its top to bottom perpetrator, author of crime, committer, individual, the person in direct perpetration of the crime, to the victim. It's a more comprehensive record than we even had at Nuremberg.
In the early days of the conflict, as opposition fighters moved into state-held territory, teams of CIJA-trained operatives went to retrieve documents. This investigator must remain anonymous for his own safety, and his words are spoken by a translator.
We've been working in a high-risk area, and we've been subject to different dangers and risks. I personally escaped from a number of explosions. We have other team members that were arrested and were released afterward. So the risks are always there, but we're still here and we're still continuing our work.
The key to their success is to blend in.
We were using different ways and disguising techniques in order to move. Each region, we adjust to what's going on in that region. For example, if we are in a Bedouin area, we can disguise as local shepherd. This we used to do it quite a lot, where we will have like a van or a truck. We put different furniture and we would just pretend to be like a local family moving from one village to another. We see the moment the regime forces will withdraw, we grab as much document as we can and we leave the area with the hope that we are getting to a safe location to save these documents until we move them to the HQ. Usually these types of operations takes like few minutes, because we are always aware of the risk. we just storm in the building, we grab as much as we can, and then withdraw, because we're always aware and afraid that there might be like shelling or like bombing from the regime. We never store our documents all in one location, but we split them into different areas. And then we start the second step, which is the preparation of moving these documents outside of the borders.
These documents paint in painful detail the regime structure, all the way to the top of the Syrian regime, up to and including President Assad.
This is Bashar al-Assad's signature here, and this is the presidential seal.
The seal of the command of the armed forces, and he is the chief of the army of the armed forces. And this shows that he really is in charge.
While the spectre of Assad on trial is still a distant one, this one is coming to a conclusion. Whatever the outcome, Patrick Croker sees this as just the beginning of a process which can go much further.
Ultimately, I think it's very important that we reach the very top of responsibility with these criminal accountability efforts. And that means going after Assad himself as well. And right now, I mean, there is a limit to do that because we are in national jurisdiction, so we can't go after an acting head of state. But everything we do can be used also against him one point in time. And I think it will be used against him one point in time.
The trial, it's not enough for sure, but we struggle for the first step and be followed with many other steps. I think it's a big step toward justice. It's an important step toward justice, but it's not the whole justice.
Ambassador Rapp, you've devoted your entire career and professional life to seeking justice for these kind of atrocity crimes. Do you think we will see justice for Syria?
It's extremely important that someone like Assad faces accountability for what he has done. Right now, he's a lesson that these rules don't apply. And a lesson to others that, rewrite the rules and stay in power. And when people go to the streets, shoot them down, they continue to protest, arrest them and torture them. That's the lesson of Assad to the rest of the world.
For now, Bashar al-Assad maintains his iron grip on Syria and continues to break international laws. To date, according to the UN, around 13 million people have been displaced. Civilians, including children, have been maimed and gassed, and hundreds of thousands murdered and forcibly disappeared.
We need to really make it clear to people that face these choices that they will eventually be in the dock. And at the moment, Assad stands for the lesson that you can get away with it, that impunity works, and the world can't live with that.
Like many Syrians, lawyer Anwar al-Bunni has suffered at the hands of the regime, and he'll be travelling to Koblenz to hear the verdict.
They arrested me, and they kidnapped me. And Anwar al-Assad was the leader of this group. He gave his destruction to everybody. You know, for me, it's not about Anwar al-Assad.
It's about systematic crimes committed by the state from all its elements, including the president himself.
We want to send message, we will follow you, we will persecute you. You never find peace after all these crimes you committed in Syria.
The once feared commander of Branch 251 has become an emblem of accountability. For the survivors, lawyers, and investigators taking part in this trial, the message to Assad is clear. You are not above the law. The evidence is ready.